Emmanuel Dimas de Melo Pimenta is a composer, architect, urban planner, photographer, and writer who hails from Sao Paulo, Brazil. He studied music with Hans Joachim Kohlreuter and Conrado Silva, and in the 1970s he began creating four-dimensional music scores inside virtual reality using analytic geometry. He met John Cage in 1985 at the Biennale of Sao Paulo, where both were giving concerts, introduced by Augusto de Campos, a mutual friend. Pimenta soon became a commissioned composer for the Merced Cunningham Dance Company, producing four scores that were used for three staged works by the company: SBBR from 1984 and Short Waves from 1985, mixed live by David Tudor for performances of Cunningham's Fabrications in 1987, Gravitational Sounds from 1989, used for Cunningham's Trackers in 1991, and Microcosmos 1991, used for Cunningham's Windows in 1995. Pimenta also composed Reed from 2009, dedicated to Cunningham, which he sent to him in celebration of the choreographer's 90th birthday. Pimenta also worked with the Swiss philosopher René Berger, and in 1990 he began an association with the Baroness Lucrezia di Domizio, a collaborator of Joseph Beuys in Italy. And from 1987 to 1997, along with Berger, Nam June Paik, Francis Ford Coppola, and others, Pimenta served as one of the directors of the Locarno Video Festival. Between 1995 and 2005, he was editor of the important art and culture magazine, Risk Art Oggi in Milan. Pimenta is prolific, having produced more than 500 compositions, 50 CDs, and more than 100 published books. From the early 1980s, he's conducted research into the fields of neurology and cognition, and is an active member of the New York Academy of Sciences. He also serves as chairman of the awards sector of the space architecture sector of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. In 2017, he was awarded the gold medal of the Academy of Arts, Sciences, and Letters of Paris. Pimenta's life is as varied as his work, dividing his time as he does between Locarno, Switzerland, his primary residence, Lisbon, and New York City. So welcome to All Things Cage, Emmanuel. How are you today?
Thank you very much. And I'm okay and well and very happy to see you.
I'm happy to see you, even if it is virtual. When was the last time we saw each other in person?
About 7 years ago.
In New York?
Yeah, in New York City.
So I know that you grew up in Sao Paulo, and this is where you met John Cage for the first time. Can you tell us the circumstances of your meeting?
Yes, of course. It was funny, strange. In fact, I grew up between Portugal, Switzerland, and Brazil, because my father, you know, was an inventor of clocks, and he had an industry, a small industry in Switzerland, in La Chaux-de-Fonds, near Neuchâtel, near Geneva. We were there many times and so on. And so I grew up in between this world. But in fact, I was born in Brazil and I lived many, many years in Brazil until 1986. In 1972, I knew for the first time John's works. It was a teacher at the school. And she put us all lying down on the floor to listen to John. And I loved it. I loved it. For me, it was the music of the future. And, you know, at that time, we all dreamed with the future. The future was the thing. You know? It was amazing. Now people stopped thinking about the future. You know? It's no longer future. It's so strange to me. And John was someone in the future of another planet, another world. Okay, I never dreamed to know him. In 1985, I was already a composer, I started composing in 79, and I was invited to make a big concert at the Biennale of São Paulo. And I joined there dozens of musicians, about three or four orchestras, spread out in the entire building of the Biennale. That is a huge building made by Oscar Niemeyer. And John Cage was the star who was invited to go there. So imagine, John was a god, you know. I was young, I was about 26. He was about 72. And our age difference was very, very big. I did not imagine to meet him. But what happened, and it's important to tell you, is that in Brazil, there is no money for art and culture, no money. And so the people at the Biennale had no money out to, you know. So, but John said, no, no, okay, if you want to go there, I want to pay me. It was more than fair. It was absolutely correct. But the people in the Biennale were furious because John asked for some money that was more than correct, you know. We all need to eat to make our lives, no? So they decided to revenge on John, to make him to pay for the money. So they transformed John in a rock star. So amazing. They put all the press, all the national press, you know, Brazil is a big country, it's 10 million people. It's very, very big. It's the fourth country in the world, largest. And they were able to put the communication to the entire media in Brazil. When John arrived in São Paulo, in the airport, he was received by 20, 30 journalists, like Mick Jagger. Like some rock star. And John told me this later, now that he never saw something alike in the world. He was, you know, all the time he was in the television, all the people surrounding him. And they said, wow, what a shame. Man, this is shameful. Poor John, they are using him. So it was very funny because in radio stations, for example, there were interviews with leaders of society saying, oh, I love John Cage. He's my preferred composer. I listen to John Cage every time I'm in the car, for example. What is an absurd. It's total absurd. No one had listened to him, but he became, from one day to another, famous, big, a big star. So I said, no, this is not right. This is absolutely not right. One day, I was in the building of the Biennale, and one of the curators arrived with John because he was bringing John from one interview to another one. But I think that this man needed to make something and said, okay, Emmanuel, keep John here for a while, and I will be back in 5 minutes. Okay, he said, wonderful. And then I said hello to John. And John was so upset. He was quiet and straight. And I was quiet and straight, but because I was ashamed because in function of all that, you know? And we said not one word to each other. We were side by side, and we said no word for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, nothing. So it's okay. And this passed, I said, okay, I will not meet him, no? This was terrible, no? So I love to have to say to him that he was my God or something like that. It's okay, no, it's impossible. So I gave my concert. That was a great success. I won the International Art Critics Association prize for that concert. It was very, very good, and John loved it. One day before he returned to New York, he had a dinner with Augusto de Campos. Augusto de Campos was one of the creators of concrete poetry. He was amazing. And he is amazing. He's still alive. He's a great friend of mine. And he was a great friend of John, too. So they had a dinner, and Augusto told John about me. And they spoke lots of time about my work and so on. And John said, oh, I'd love to know this guy. It's okay, but we have no longer time. Next day, before going to the airport, John was giving autographs to his book from Aya to Mongol, translated into Portuguese, by Augusto and by two other guys. And so I was with Luciana, who you know so well. We are married for a long time. And I said, forget. I will never, ever be with John Cage. You see that he is surrounded by people. All people want to, everyone wants to take some part of him. I don't want that. I think that's so terrible, no, to mix something I like with a person, no? But when we went to the door, to going out from the building, Augusto de Campos saw me at a distance, no? And he ran at me and grasped my arm and said, Emmanuel, you did not meet John Cage yet. You don't meet John Cage yet. No, so wait a minute. You need to know him. Come here. And he pushed me to be with John. And he said, John, this is the guy about whom I spoke to you yesterday evening. And John said, oh, this is wonderful. And full of people, dozens and dozens of people, everyone wanted something from John. And he said, oh, come here. And we went to a back. And he said, you know, I cannot talk to you. You see the people surrounding me. I don't know what I do with these people. But how can we be in touch? I said, oh, I give you my address and you give me yours. And we exchanged our addresses. And this was our first meeting.
That's amazing. What an amazing story. So he behaved, he was not happy, but he behaved well.
Absolutely well. John was a gentleman. John was the sweetest and the most generous and brilliant, maybe the most person like that I met in my life.
Yeah, I feel the same way, Emmanuel. I have a similar, very silly story, very short, when I was with John Cage in the Czech Republic. This was on his last tour in 1992. And he was not very healthy, and our schedule was terribly full, and the press was everywhere. And we were at the performance site, and all John wanted to do was to eat. He hadn't had any proper food all day long. And the press was there, and everybody wanted something from him. And the presenter came up to me, and she said, oh, Laura, can you help us? We need to have John Cage sign these documents, and you can see he's surrounded by people. Can you push to the front and get him to sign this? So I took the papers, and I got into the line, everyone wanting to say hello to John. And he was so miserable. I could see it. So I thought and I thought, and when I got up there, I kneeled down in front of him and I said, oh, Mr. Cage, my cousin Jethro at home, he just loves your work. I was wondering if you could autograph this for Jethro. And I put this contract in front of him. And he looked at me, and for the first time in hours, big smile. And I said, oh, and wait, his wife, Susanna, she loves your music. Could you sign this for her? Because there was five or six documents to sign. And he signed them all. And by the end, he was so relaxed. So then I left and 50 more people came. He was very understanding about that. People all wanted their minute, You know, they all wanted something from him that was very important for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing happened. Few seconds before we met in that moment, that is very revealing about his character, this kind of gentleman he was. It was a beautiful girl, and she arrived with a book to him, but she had the red lips. No? She was very sensual, no? And she arrived to him and said, "John, I don't want you writing in the book. I want a kiss." Of course, that was to publish in all newspapers. No, that's he kissed John and so on. And he made the movement to kiss him in the mouth, of course. No? And John, very, very sweet and very delicate also, he took the book and kissed the book and gave the book to her. And he said, "Here you have your kiss."
That's so sweet. Who was that? Who was the woman?
I don't know.
Oh, just a woman, a society lady?
Yeah, absolutely.
So then he left. He went back to New York right away after you met him. And then you began to write back and forth?
No. Again, it's not, our story is not linear. In that moment, I had a cassette tape in my pocket. That was a concept I had dedicated to him in 1984. But I did not tell him that was dedicated to him at that moment because it was written, published, and so on. But I did not tell because it was too much. Now to say, "Oh, this is dedicated to you." I gave the cassette to him and he said, "Oh, thank you very much." Okay. 6 months passed. I moved to Portugal. And nothing. And they said to the same, "You see, John Cage, I gave the address and so on. And he told me that he would write me and nothing. Nothing. 6, 7 months passed, nothing. Okay. I returned to Brazil to visit the parks and so on and see some things there, business and so on, you know. And then the curator of the Biennale called me. Said, "Oh, Emmanuel, I know you are in Brazil. You are here in São Paulo. Oh, how is your relationship with John Cage?" So I said, "What?" "Yes, you have worked with him." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "No, you know, he called us 30 times and he is looking for you." So what happened is that John tried to call me many, many times and the people blocked it. The people cut our connection. He did not send me any information about that. And they said to him, even having my address, new address and so on, they said they knew nothing about me, anything. So in that moment, I had John's phone, you know, and I called him. Immediately. And I asked him, "Sorry." No, I said, "Excuse me." And he said, "Emmanuel, don't say that. The world is like that. you must not be worried." But I love the concert for Frogs and Crickets. You dedicated that. "And Mars and I would love to include one of your pieces in one of dances, Mars's dances." And we started working. Basically, it was
that. Amazing. And that was the first, well, I guess it was 2 scores you sent, and they decided to use them both.
Yes. Also, it was not linear. In fact, he decided to use Shortwave 1985. That was a piece I recorded in the middle of the forests in Brazil. I went to the forest. My father loved technology, you know. And when it was the military dictatorship in Brazil, he was very afraid of the situation because it was very tense. He lived very, very tense moments there. And so every day, about 7 p.m., he opened a place there in the living room where he had a Telefunken, very large Telefunken radio, shortwave radio, but a big one, German, very good, a big one. And he listened to the BBC to have a notion about what was happening inside Brazil. So you needed to listen to England to know what was happening in Brazil. Well, okay, the world changed, and one day he gave me this big radio that was very powerful. And I decided to bring it to the middle of the forests to catch what the world was saying, captured in the middle of the forest in Brazil. And this was the base for the shortwaves 1985. So, but you know, we never knew, never. And this is another curiosity. When I was a boy, I made a theater. And I studied a lot of Antonin Artaud, the French playwright. Artaud was very, very important, very famous. And I studied a lot of him, even very young. And one of the things Artaud said and created, even in a small book that is so beautiful, that is Le Théâtre et son double, is the principle of independence of arts. That was in 1936 or 38, if I'm not wrong. And that was very important to me. When I knew about John, I knew that he and Moss also hold this principle of independence of arts. So for me, it was my way also to think. Also was very good for we all. So I never knew about what Moss was doing. Never, ever. Never. Moss never told me, oh, I'm making something like that. The maximum, he said, was the timing. That was the maximum.
Right. That was true for everybody, Emmanuel.
Yes, I know. So what happened is that even timing could change, and it changed. So fabrications.
Fabrications being, for our listening audience, the name of the piece by Merce Cunningham that was going to be using Emmanuel's music.
Yeah, absolutely. And fabrications changed also, and then John called me and said, no, no, we need more music. How can you do that? But then it was a dilemma, no? Because if I would make more music, I would be following to something. And it would be a degeneration, according to the Artaud's principle. And I said to John, I cannot do that. The music is that, no? And he said, oh, I need to think for a while. So he had a lot of my things, my pieces, because you know me, Laura.
I do. I smiled. The radio audience can't see me, but I'm smiling.
Yeah. I sent to John lots of things. Poor John. Sorry, John, where you are now. So, and then some days later, he called me and said, Emmanuel, there is a second part. Because I had recorded the Shortwaves 1985 in a cassette tape, and after Shortwaves 1985, I recorded also East BBR. But I did not write that. I did not write that. So John did not know, and he said, no, there is a second part of the piece. That is totally different. No? And I said, no, no, this is another piece. He said, okay, for us it's perfect. So is that timing we need? Some days later, he called me again and said, Mano, we need more music. How, John, I cannot do. What can we do? He said, no, I can give a gift to you. I can create a moment of silence between them. And it's a gift I give to you. I said, you're wonderful. And so publications was ready.
I see. So it's really three things. Right. It's really three compositions, two by you and one by John Cage. all mixed together by David Tudor.
And David Tudor was so sweet too. I love him. Love him.
He was a very kind man. So that was your first experience working with MERS, so to speak. Had you spent much time with MERS up to then?
No, up to then, no, nothing. We met three times or not less than this, because I sent all this material in 86. I had not met John, MERS, sorry. John I had met, but not MERS. MERS I would meet for the first time in 87. And I would become very near MERS after John's death.
Yes, yeah. That was true for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, because MERS was very more private than John. And also he, I think, was a little overwhelmed by the sheer number of people in John's life. So he tended to go elsewhere when there were a lot of people around.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and sometimes MERS disappeared. No?
Exactly.
So we got very, very near, very close to each other, MERS and I, particularly in the 2000s, 90s and 2000s. At the point that in the last 3 or 4 years of life, I called him every Sunday. Every Sunday I called him. So it was very special. No?
Yeah.
It was very beautiful.
There were a couple of people, you being one, also Pia Gilbert. She used to always call on Sunday morning and find out what he was doing at 9 o'clock in the morning. He was usually sitting there drinking tea in his pajamas. But you, in the meantime, you made works for Cunningham during Cage's lifetime. Yes, the remaining works. You did a work for Trackers.
Yeah.
And you also did a piece for him for his windows in 1995. So that one was after John died. Were those easier and more clear-cut in terms of time? They don't have that dramatic story?
No, it was, for example, Trackers. That is very interesting. I knew what it would be because MERS had told me about Life Forms.
For our listening audience, Life Forms was a computer software program that MERS Cunningham used, was trained on by a woman named Kekla Shiphorst from Canada. It permitted him to put choreography on computer-generated figures and to experiment with certain steps and certain moves. So by 1995, MERS was using Life Forms on a regular basis.
Yes, and Trackers was the first piece using Life Forms. And we were in a dinner with John, and we talked a lot about that because I worked with virtual reality since the 70s. A moment that no one knew about that. No? So I did not have money to computer, so I worked in conceptual terms with analytic geometry and so on. It was not easy. So that was, I think that's in 89 or 90 when we talked about. And when MERS invited me through John to have a piece for the new piece, I did not know about anything, but I knew that he was using Life Forms. And that was enough to me. I said, no, wait a minute. I need to make something very special here. Very, very special, because it's an historical moment. So I created a strange mathematical attractor. A strange mathematical attractor is a couple of equations that in the incognito of the one feeds the second, and the second feeds the one, and the first one is an algorithm. But depending on the number you put in the beginning, the number you have will be chaotic, but will be in orbit. It will never escape infinity. But if you go 0.00001 up or down, that number, the result goes to the escapes from the orbit. So what I made was to create that orbit, and every time the number passed a certain point, a sound was generated. That was chaos, was totally random, but at the same time, it was deterministic also, because depended on the first number I put. And it was, I think, the first time a music was composed with mathematical, a strange mathematical attraction, which happened totally inside virtual reality. So I thought, well, this is very interesting, because is music working inside virtual reality, and the dance also working in virtual reality. So when I sent to Merce, it was very funny because he loved it, and David Tudor also loved it. I remember I went to Madrid, I think that it was in, I don't know, 91. That was the beginning of this piece. And David Tudor was so kind. He arrived to me, he was much older than me. You know? I was a boy. And he looked at me and said, "Manu, do you like what I did?" No. He was great. No, I said, "David, you are wonderful, amazing." No. I want to know very seriously if you like what I'm doing.
That's lovely. That was a piece by you called Gravitational Sounds. Yes?
Is because of this. Now,
yes.
It's clear why of the title.
Of course. And then you did one more for Merce that he used for a piece, and that was for his windows. That was the third one. And by the way, were you able to attend the premiere performances of the other two pieces?
No.
No. So you had not yet come to New York?
I was penniless, you know.
Yes, of course.
No money.
So no. So the answer is no.
I had no money to buy an aero ticket to go to another country. I was young, and it was not easy. But this fourth piece for Merce, it was Microcosmos, and it was based on the molecular structure of ferrous metal. Because one thing that I think that is important to say, you know this, my work is to change the logic, what happens in our brains. So I'm not interested to imitate this or that one or make, no. What is important to me is to create a logical structure that in some way will enter in conflict with the standards, or logical standards, that are already in our brains. It's this I have studied for 35 years, 40 years. Why? Because only difference produces consciousness. And art and music are enlightening. So if you have no difference, you have no consciousness, you have no awareness about the thing, about reality. So what I did, and many times, all my life I have did it, you know, is to catch from something outside our world, our reality, the elements to structure my piece, my works on music or fashion, doesn't matter. So in this case of Microcosmos, I enter in the nanoscale of matter, where the logics of articulation between the elements are absolutely different of what we have in our scale. And I brought these relations to our world. And so you have a strange sensation. Sometimes it seems conventional, but then you say, no, wait a minute. There is something here, strange. And this strangeness is what is interesting, is what changes your brain and is something to push one to be aware. No? I don't
know. So interesting. Emmanuel, do you think that Merce understood your work at all?
Yes.
Yeah?
We talked a lot about that. A lot. When we traveled together, for example, in Paris and so on, we talked a lot. We talked many times and I explained it to him. But not only Merce, but even Kozubi. I remember very well one day at Merce's home. I was with Kozubi and he said something that I said, oh, wait a minute. He is not understanding what is behind, no? And we started a conversation that was very, very interesting about all these philosophical questions. Another moment, I was in Lyon with Merce, Kozubi, and Christian Wolff. And, you know, Merce was always separated, and the musicians were separated from the dancers. I never understood very well this. No, I loved the dancers also. So, and I'm friend of some of them even today. All us, we are old. No. And I went to have a lunch with Christian and Kozubi. Kozubi had a big problem because he did not eat, almost did not eat Western food. He needed to eat Eastern food all the time.
Yes, that's correct. And also his English was not so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, but this is very interesting what I tell you. So, well, we talked a lot and so on. And then, in one lunch, I think that I mentioned Beethoven. I had found a score by Beethoven that was new, a new discovery in Lyon. I'm a flutist, you know, and so this was for flute and was very strange to me. And I had this score on my hands and so on. And I mentioned that in the lunch. And Kozubi looked at me and said, but Beethoven, Beethoven is horrible. No? Because one day John had said about Beethoven, but in another context, another situation. And I said, Kozubi, wait a minute. Beethoven was a genius. It was great. No, we have, it's another time. It's a different thing. No? And Christian also said, no, Emmanuel is right. And I said, Kozubi, listen to the quartets, the Beethoven last quartets. No, you'll be amazing. Some moments that are absolutely amazing. And then we started a long conversation with me about philosophy of composition and so on. So I know, Merce knew, and we talked a lot about that all the time.
Fair enough. For our listening audience, Cage, he had nothing against poor Beethoven. He just, this was what Emmanuel is talking about, is when John Cage was at Black Mountain College, and he was producing a series of concerts of the music of Erik Satie. So there was also a string quartet, a resident string quartet at Black Mountain, who were playing all the Beethoven quartets at the same time. And Cage made a comment that Beethoven was wrong and that Satie was right, because Satie had organized his compositions by time, which was more in keeping with the way John Cage created his compositions, not through harmonic development or progression, but through time. And this has come down through the ages as John Cage hated Beethoven.
Yeah.
Which Kusugi was repeating.
Absolutely.
I'm sure, Emmanuel, that Christian was extremely interested in your music and extremely interested in your ideas. He's very much a classicist, very, very interested in philosophy. So I can imagine you had wonderful conversations with him.
Yeah, you know, Christian is a friend until now, time to time. You know, not very much because, you know, we are in different continents now. but I write him to know how he sings and so on. He is a lovely person, and he's a great musician.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And he's also, we fondly call him the last man standing.
I hope that we have more in the world, no bad.
I agree. I agree. So we've talked mostly about your music, which I love that we're doing this because it's not so easy to find you this way for people. You did one more work for Cunningham, but this last one was a gift that you sent him for his 90th birthday in 2009 called Reed. Can you tell us about that? We're actually going to listen to this piece at the end of today's show, but can you tell us something about it? What's Reed about? How did you make it?
One day I was walking with Moss. I don't remember where, maybe in Paris. And I had mentioned to him that sometimes the dancers in the company were not so strong. Some of them, few of them. So we could feel the efforts they made with their bodies, that the body crumbled a little. And I said, what do you think about that? And he said to me, each body is a dance. Each body has its own dance. And look at ahead, Mama. The people walking in the streets. Each one walks in a different way. I don't want to impose my dance to anyone. I want to have the dance that is natural in the body of each one. So each one is different, and this difference is what is beautiful for me. And so, you know, this is my philosophy of life also. I love the diversity. I love the difference between people. Even when I with my friends and someone say something I don't agree, I love it. Because I bring that. I think on that. I grow. I discover new things about the thing we are talking, you know? So difference for me is essential. Essential. I the world would be boring to have everyone equal. You know? So I don't want that. I want diversity. Each one different, not everyone. And Mars was a thought, and John also thought like that. I think that was so good. Difference of ideas, of everything with respect. So for his 90 years, I decided to compose something working with the steps of the people, with the difference of steps. And how could I do that? And I thought, and I recovered an old book, the photos of Edward Muybridge. That was so important. So I think that everyone knows well about his work with not only with the horse, no walk, but also with people. And I took all these pictures of people walking made by Edward Muybridge in the 1800s. And I measured the difference between the steps, and the difference between the steps generated principle of relation that was projected on a musical score. It's important to say also that I work with graphical scores since the 70s. And many people think, oh, okay, it's a graphical score is not precision. No, it's nothing to do. You can have more precision in graphical score. It's just that a graphical score is more open to different logics than the conventional score. I have the classical formation, so I can read, and I read every day a classical score, but the three-dimensional is even more open to new logics, not new structures of relations. And when I talk about four-dimensional virtual score, it's because I open the possibility of the musician to walk inside the music. That is time, and time is the fourth dimension. But what I did was that, and I gave to Mars. A few weeks before he passed away, he told me he loved it. No, I don't know. I don't know, but he said we called. No, I called him, and so he told me he had loved it. So okay, then I invited a jazz musician. I love jazz, you know. Ornette Coleman was a brother too. We played together for 15 years at his home, and he was great. One day, because we are talking, no, Ornette was so curious to know John, and no one knows about this story, that he went to a concert of John, which was in a basement somewhere in downtown. I don't know. Ornette told me that. And it was a very controversy because John was criticizing by Charles Mingus and other people from the jazz world, you know? Because John said one day, it's always those things, you know, that he thought that jazz improvisation was many times the same thing, and he loved different things. And Charles Mingus was very offended and saying that he was white and the other was black. You know, this is stories. Huh? And John was not that. John was very open. Ornette was curious to know him because Ornette was open too. And said, wait a minute, but I want to know this guy, what he's doing. No, and he went to a basement where John was performing. And he said, Manuel, that was in the 60s. And the building, Thai building, trembled like a heartbeat because of the sounds of John. And Ornette loved that and said, no. John Cage is not these things people are talking about, no? But they never met each other. So I invited Paul Goldberg, that is this great friend of mine in New York, who is a good, very, very talented sax player. And I played flute in improvisation on this piece dedicated to Mascandi.
What a beautiful way to end our program, Emmanuel. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
No, I thank you so much. You know how, since so many years, and how I love you, very respectfully, and is very sincere, how your work is important for the world.
Thank you
so much for everything.
Now let's listen to an excerpt from Reed, performed by Emmanuel Dimas de Mella Pimenta on flute and Paul Goldberg on sax. Mm-hmm.